Bonne année. Happy New Year. It's rare that we get to meet on the first day of a new year. So let's enjoy it and enjoy each other's company. We're in chapter 23 in the first series on Essays on the Gita. The title of the chapter is Nirvana and Works in the World. It was published on the 15th of June in 1918, and as we saw last time, Sri Aurobindo's insistence that we can do the best work in the world when we are without ego and without desire, living in felt, deep communion and identity with the Supreme. That allows us to work and move beautifully in the cosmos. We must be free of ego. We must somehow get to this station of consciousness in which, while we move in the mutable world, we live also simultaneously in the eternal spirit. Sri Aurobindo is in the middle of this essay where we take this up, and we take the last sentence of the previous paragraph first. It is the self which we are within, the supreme self of our individual being, but also the self which we are without, the supreme self of the universe, the self of all existences. By living in that self, we live in all, and no longer in our egoistic being alone. By oneness with that self, a steadfast oneness with all in the universe becomes the very nature of our being and the root status of our active consciousness and root motive of all our action. I know I seem to say this every couple of weeks, but remember, Sri Aurobindo has done this. By this inning in his life, and he's writing in 1918, he began the practice of his yoga with the realization of nirvana. So the blotting out of the separative sense of ego was his first great spiritual achievement. But it permitted him, a year or so later, working and living from the Alipur jail, that he began to see this universal Godhead, this Purushottama, everywhere, and to realize his own identity with it. And that is what allowed him, when he came out of the Alipur jail, not only to resume his activities in the political sphere for the liberation of India, but then to stand beyond that revolutionary action and aim at a revolution within the world as a whole, to introduce to it a new level of consciousness, a new possibility, something beyond the dualities and the divisions of the mind, something that really lives and acts from a harmony that the soul feels so called to. So here we are talking about that. Sri Aurobindo has been working here in Chapter 5, Karma Sannyasa Yoga, and he's going to transition soon into Chapter 6, Dhyana Yoga, to underscore a point. Let's move forward. But again, we get immediately afterwards two verses which might seem to lead away from this conclusion. Having put outside of himself all outward touches and concentrated the vision between the eyebrows and made equal the prana and the apana moving within the nostrils, having controlled the senses, the mind, and the understanding, the sage, devoted to liberation, from whom desire and wrath and fear have passed away, is ever free. chapter 5, shlokas 27 and 28. Now you'll recognize here this making the breath even, rising and falling, controlling the senses, not allowing the mind to run hither and yon. All of this sounds like something else that we're familiar with. Let's move on to that next sentence then. Here, we have a process of yoga that brings in an element which seems quite other than the yoga of works and other even than the pure yoga of knowledge by discrimination and contemplation. It belongs in all its characteristic features to the system, introduces the psychophysical ascesis of Raja Yoga, the royal path of yoga. So remember, the first step of knowledge was that standpoint that Sankhya offers. Enumerate the things that you think populate your life, and you'll find that all of it is a play of nature. So who is it that is watching nature? Who is that witness? Ah, that is the Purusha. Let me stand farther and farther back from obvious nature, and I discover that there is also an inner nature. And the ego is bound up with this inner nature, which pushes itself out into action in the outer world. But the more deeply I sit in my real self as Purusha, then I no longer identify with that. So that's the Sankhyan insight. But here we seem to have something espoused to champion Raja Yoga. This path, which is already extant and visible here in the Bhagavad Gita, about 500 years later, gets articulated in the Yoga Sutras as Patanjali brought them forward. They're not identical. In fact, the term Raja Yoga does not occur here in the Gita, and is sometimes associated with and sometimes differentiated from the practice that Patanjali champions. Let's go forward with this paragraph. There is the conquest of all the movements of the mind, citta vritti nirodha. There is the control of the breathing, pranayama. There is the drawing in of the sense and the vision. All of them are processes which lead to the inner trance of samadhi. The object of all of them, moksha. And moksha signifies, in ordinary parlance, the renunciation not only of the separative ego consciousness, but of the whole active consciousness, a dissolution of our being into the highest Brahman. So this is the Yoga Sutras in its first part, its first chapter. Of course, Citta Vritti Nirodha, that's chapter 1, shloka 2, or sutra 2. And then the rest of this is enumerated in chapter 2 in the Yoga Sutras, basically, let's say around 229. Remember, the Yoga Sutras is having us first go through the practice of yama and niyama, to practice the restraints and the injunctions, to get control over our external being, and mend the way that we interact with the world. And then when we've begun to accomplish these ethical facets of a yoga practice, we begin to sit, take the asana, become still, impose upon the body oneness. And then we learn how to draw our breath upwards and inwards, and then expel it all in a very slow rhythm, and that has a huge impact on the capacity of the body to feel peace. And then upon this peaceful marriage of breath and body, we begin to withdraw our attention from the senses. Pratyahara. We begin not to pay attention to whether it's hot or cold in the room, whether emotions are heaving in our chest with the ideas that want to populate our head. We're drawing our attention away. And then, having drawn them away, moving into the gulfs of our consciousness, we concentrate. That concentration leads to the steady flow of consciousness around the object of its choice, whether it's an image or a mantra, and that is dhyana. And dhyana takes us stage after stage out of dualism, out of subject and object, and towards that. And eventually, one hits the mark. The gulf between the two disappears. The subject and the object, the self and the thing we love, become one. And that is samadhi. And there are various stages of samadhi. But this is the process of this kind of yoga. Now, the yoga in the Gita recognizes this. Patanjali spells it out step by step in the most difficult language you can imagine. So, enjoy if you decide to pick it up and read. Read carefully. Most of all, practice. So, back to Sri Aurobindo here. The mention of moksha, you see, moksha is not a word that occurs either in the Yoga Sutras or really in the Gita. That's a term, the freedom that moksha speaks to, I think occurs most often in Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta at that. So the last phrase was a dissolution of our being into the highest Brahman. The particle becomes part of the whole, the drop becomes a part of the ocean, etc. So Sri Aurobindo poses the question, are we to suppose that the Gita gives this process in that sense as the last movement of a release by dissolution, or only as a special means and a strong aid to overcome the outward going mind? Is this the finale, the climax, the last word? We shall find reason to regard it as both a special means, an aid, and at least one gate of a final departure, not by dissolution, but by an uplifting to the supracosmic existence. So, this is important because, yes, this practice, which isolates the being within, need not isolate you from the world, but could lift you up, you see, to the next stages of being, out of being identified with the Kshara Purusha, if you remember, the mutable personality constantly changing, and into identity with the Atman, the Akshara Purusha, who is free and eternal above the play, and yet positing its own presence of self in the here and now of the succeeding moments. He continues, for even here, in this passage, this is not the last word. The last word, the finale, the climax comes in a verse that follows and is the last couplet of the chapter. When a man has known me as the enjoyer of sacrifice and tapasya, of all ascesis and energisms, the mighty Lord of all the worlds, the friend of all creatures, he comes by the peace. The power of the Karma Yoga comes in again. The knowledge of the active Brahman, the cosmic supersoul, is insisted on among the conditions of the peace of Nirvana. So again, the Purushottama speaking through Krishna on the field of Kurukshetra to the great warrior Arjuna is not asking him to come away, but to come up, step up a level. Come live in this peace. There's more. We get back to the great idea of the Gita, the idea of the Purushottama. Though that name is not given till close upon the end, it is always that which Krishna means by his I and me, the divine, who is there as the one self and our timeless immutable being, who is present too in the world, in all existences, in all activities, the master of the silence and the peace, the master of the power and the action, who is here, incarnate, as the divine charioteer of the stupendous conflict, the transcendent, the self, the all, the master of every individual being. He is the enjoyer of all sacrifice and of all tapasya. Therefore shall the seeker of liberation do works as a sacrifice and as a tapasya. He is the Lord of all the worlds, manifested in nature and in these beings. Therefore shall the liberated man still do works for the right government and leading on of the peoples in these worlds, Loka Sangraha. He is the friend of all existences. Therefore, is the sage who has found Nirvana within him and all around, still and always occupied with the good of all creatures, even as the Nirvana of Mahayana Buddhism took for its highest sign the works of a universal compassion, Mahakarna. Therefore, too, even when he has found oneness with the divine in his timeless and immutable self, is he still capable, since he embraces the relations also of the play of nature, of divine love for man and of love for the divine, of bhakti. The Lord of all the worlds, manifested, made clear, brought forth in nature, Vasudeva, whom Sri Aurobindo knew so well in his practice of yoga, all by himself in that lonely cell in Alipur. Loka Sangraha, the holding together of the worlds. How do you hold the worlds together? If you don't hold them together in your consciousness first, as does the divine, then you can't. It's an idea. It's a concept. It's a conceit. But if you want to work in the world and transform it, this has to be real to you. It has to be part of your concrete psychological experience. And of course, Loka Sangraha, chapter 3, 20 and 25. Vasudeva is mentioned appealingly in chapter 7, shloka 19. That this is the drift of the meaning becomes clearer when we have fathomed the sense of the sixth chapter, which is a large comment on and a full development of the idea of these closing verses of the fifth. That shows the importance which the Gita attaches to them. So remember, we're moving from karma sannyasa into dhyana. Why is dhyana important? Why do we want to refine our consciousness so that we can actually live this? So it's a practical, not simply a theoretical point that the Gita is about to make in chapter 6. And we're going to find that Sri Aurobindo is going to go through this sedulously, one shloka at a time. He says, we shall therefore run as briefly as possible through the substance of this sixth chapter. First, the teacher emphasizes, and this is very significant, his often repeated asseveration about the real essence of sannyasa, that it is an inward, not an outward renunciation. You all know the word translated into English as renunciation. Hold on just a moment. Let me see here. Here we go. But renunciation is one thing, but it's not the outer renunciation that the Gita and, of course, Sri Aurobindo is aiming at, but the inner freedom. So, whoever does the work to be done without resort to its fruits, he is the sannyasin and the yogin, not the man who lights not the sacrificial fire and does not the works. So in other words, walking away from the world doesn't make you free. You might still very much be trapped in your own bundle of desires and thoughts, just like you were before, but now you're without any support of the family, without any useful constructive action in the world. You're just gone. So that's chapter 6, shlokas 1 and 2. What they have called renunciation, sannyasa, know to be in truth yoga. For none becomes a yogin who has not renounced the desire will in the mind. Desire will, huh? So this is that level of selfhood between ahankara and buddhi, which we begin to identify with as we are an object and a construct of nature in the mind, not the soul, not the purusha, but we're talking about the natural being here. Works are to be done, but with what purpose and in what order? They are first to be done while ascending the hill of yoga, for then works are the cause, karanam. The cause of what? The cause of self-perfection, 6.3. Of liberation, of nirvana in the Brahman. For by doing works with a steady practice of the inner renunciation, this perfection, this liberation, this conquest of the desire mind and the desire self and the lower nature are easily accomplished. Sri Aurobindo found it personally much, much more facile to work in the world and push towards India's liberation after the realization of Nirvana, Brahman Nirvana, in 1908, than before. He was no longer married egoistically to the doing, and so the doing worked better. But when one has got to the top, then works are no longer the cause. The calm of self-mastery and self-possession gained by works becomes the cause. Again, the cause of what? Of fixity in the self, in the Brahman consciousness, and of the perfect equality in which the divine works of the liberated man are done. Now we're going back to the second chapter with that. Brahmistiti, that's 272, and Samatva, that's 248. Equality, 248, and standing in the Brahman, 272. So we practice yoga, we do works as an offering, and that carries us up. We get liberated. And then we continue to do works for the welfare of the world, bringing yoga back down. We used works to ascend, and we come back to work in the world, having been liberated, to free all as an act of compassion, as a gift, as a giving. For when one does not get attached to the objects of sense or to works and has renounced all will of desire in the mind, then is he said to have ascended to the top of yoga. And that's 6.4. That, as we already know, is the spirit in which the liberated man does works. He does them without desire and attachment, without the egoistic personal will and the mental seeking, which is the parent of desire. He has conquered his lower self, reached the perfect calm in which his highest self is manifest to him, that highest self always concentrated in his own being, samahita in samadhi, that's 6-7, not only in the trance of the inward drawn consciousness, but always in the waking state of the mind as well, in exposure to the causes of desire and of the disturbance of calm, to grief and pleasure, heat and cold, honor and disgrace, all the dualities, sitoshna sukha dukeshu tata manapanamanayaho. This higher self is the akshara, kutastha, which stands above the changes and the perturbations of the natural being. And the yogin is said to be in yoga with it when he also is like it, kutastha, unchangeable, when he is superior to all appearances and mutations, when he is satisfied with self-knowledge, when he is equal-minded to all things and happenings and persons. That's chapter 6, 5 through 9. And onward we go. But this yoga is, after all, no easy thing to acquire, as Arjuna indeed shortly afterwards suggests, for the restless mind is always liable to be pulled down from these heights by the attacks of outward things and to fall back into the strong control of grief and passion and inequality. Therefore, it would seem, the Gita proceeds to give us, in addition to its general method of knowledge and works, a special process of Raja Yogic meditation also, a powerful method of practice, abhyasa, a strong way to the complete control of the mind and all its workings. So he's back to why Raja Yoga is important here. In this process, the yogin is directed to practice continually union with the self, so that that may become his normal consciousness. So practice union with the self. In other words, you might get there for a moment, and then you're drawn back, as Arjuna suggests. It's so easy to fall back. Gravity pulls you back to the old way of being. But you assert again your will to achieve, and again you have that experience. You move closer. You have the longer duration of that light within you acting through you, and over a period of time, the experience deepens into realization and becomes flawlessly present. He is to sit apart and alone, with all desire and idea of possession banished from his mind, self-controlled in his whole being and consciousness. That's 6:10. Quote, he should set in a pure spot his firm seat, neither too high nor yet too low, covered with a cloth, with a deer skin, with sacred grass, and there, seated with a concentrated mind and with the workings of the mental consciousness and the senses under control, he should practice yoga for self-purification, atma vishuddhaye. That's 6:12. Well, that's actually 6:11 through 15, including 6:12 there. So I think the Gita is offering this as, yes, take this conforming picture that you're very familiar with and use this. But it's a temporary tool. You don't get fixed in that. The asana for the spirit is infinite and malleable. It is not simply sitting in the cross-legged position on a deerskin. The posture he takes must be the motionless, erect posture proper to the practice of Raja Yoga. The vision should be drawn in and fixed between the eyebrows, not regarding the regions, not wandering around looking at things. The mind is to be kept calm and free from fear, and the vow of brahmacharya observed. The whole controlled mentality must be devoted and turned to the divine so that the lower action of the consciousness shall be merged in the higher peace. Well, by the time we get to the Mahabharata, brahmacharya begins to mean a certain thing. Really, it means the path that takes you to the Brahman, the path that takes you to divine being. But anything pursuit of desire takes you away from that. And so you sedulously stay away from all things, especially the elements of desire, which call to you most naturally. So, but again, Krishna, Arjuna, all the great warriors on the field, many of whom have realization and are divine in their very nature, are married and have lots of children. So it is not exclusionary in that sense. Brahmacharya should mean to us that our consciousness is wedded to that. That is what it means. And our actions should be true and good, as Brahman is true and good. For the object to be attained is the still peace of nirvana. Thus, always putting himself in yoga by control of his mind, the yogin attains to the supreme peace of nirvana, which has its foundation in me, shantim nirvana paramam madsanstam. That's 6:15. This peace of nirvana is reached when all the mental consciousness is perfectly controlled and liberated from desire and remains still in the self. Avatishtate. When motionless, like the light of a lamp in a windless place, it ceases from its restless action, shut in from its outward motion, and by the silence and stillness of the mind, the self is seen within, not disfigured as in the mind, but in the self, seen not as it is mistranslated falsely or partially by the mind and represented to us through the ego, but self perceived by the self, swaprakasha. That section is 6:18 through 20. So you see, one is restored beyond the modalities of prakriti, back to the sheer essence of the purusha. One is established in that, and the gaze from the soul will now be able to give proper and righteous direction to nature as to how to act. Then, he writes, the soul is satisfied and knows its own true and exceeding bliss, not that untranquil happiness which is the portion of the mind and the senses, but an inner and serene felicity in which it is safe from the mind's perturbations and can no longer fall away from the spiritual truth of its being. Not even the fieriest assault of mental grief can disturb it, for mental grief comes to us from outside, is a reaction to external touches, and this is the inner, the self-existent happiness of those who no longer accept the slavery of the unstable mental reactions to external touches, 6:22 and 23. It is the putting away of the contact with pain, the divorce of the mind's marriage with grief, dukkha sanyoga viyogam, the firm winning of this inalienable spiritual bliss is yoga. It is the divine union. It is the greatest of all gains, and the treasure beside which all others lose their value. Therefore, is this yoga to be resolutely practiced without yielding to any discouragement by difficulty or failure until the release, until the bliss of nirvana is secured as an eternal possession? Strive, achieve. This is the goal. Without that, divine work in the world is not possible. One has to have this spiritual release. So we're going to put a bookmark there and finish the chapter next week. I'm going to read, with your permission, a section from Savitri in Book 7, the Book of Yoga. Canto 6, Nirvana, and the All-Negating Absolute. I think we'll start on page 541, and I think you'll see the relevance. This world is a vast, unbroken totality. A deep solidarity joins its contrary powers. God's summits look back on the mute abyss. So man, evolving to divinest heights, colloques still with the animal and the jinn. The human godhead with stargazer eyes lives still in one house with the primal beast. The high meets the low. All is a single plan. So she beheld the many births of thought, if births can be of what eternal is. For the eternal's powers are like himself, timeless in the timeless, in time ever born. This too she saw, that all in outer mind is made, not born, a product perishable, forged in the body's factory by earth force. This mind is a dynamic small machine producing ceaselessly till it wears out, with raw material drawn from the outside world, the patterns sketched out by an artist god. Often our thoughts are finished cosmic wares, admitted by a silent office gate and passed through the subconscious galleries, then issued in time's mart as private make. For now, they bear the living person's stamp. A trick, a special hue, claims them his own. All else is nature's craft, and this too hers. Our tasks are given. We are but instruments. Nothing is all our own that we create. The power that acts in us is not our force. The genius, too, receives from some high fount, concealed in a supernal secrecy, the work that gives him an immortal name. The word, the form, the charm, the glory and grace are missioned sparks from a stupendous fire, a sample from the laboratory of God, of which he holds the patent upon earth, comes to him wrapped in golden coverings. He listens for inspiration's postman knock and takes delivery of the priceless gift, a little spoilt by the receiver mind or mixed with the manufacture of his brain. When least defaced, then is it most divine. Although his ego claims the world for its use, man is a dynamo for the cosmic work. Nature does most in him. God, the high rest. Only his soul's acceptance is his own. This independent, once a power supreme, self-born before the universe was made, accepting cosmos, binds himself nature's serf till he becomes her freedman or God's slave. Ah, did I neglect to mention that while this is the book of yoga, Canto 6 is Nirvana and the all-negating absolute. So, much love. Namaste. Jai Ma.